Hello, good evening, welcome. I am Samuel Trapp. This is Dem Radio, as you just heard. And this program is international flavor. I'm glad to be here tonight. Glad to have all of you listening in. Plenty of news going on. And there's been some, as usual, spats over social media. This is our life these days. If you're not involved in social media spats and arguments yourself, you get to hear all about them, about the leader of the supposedly the most powerful man in the world. Actually, he is the most powerful man in the world, although arguably that is changing. And so there are battles going on. As you know, the BRICS conference was just concluding, and we had news as of yesterday. Rather entertaining news and commentary and drama, if you will, from both sides. By the way, if you'd like to call in tonight, you may do so, 573-746-8020, and I might be happy to talk to you. Could be fun. And I don't know. There's so much news going on, so many things to talk about, and I just, you know, I'm trying to figure out. I've decided where I'm going to start, but it wouldn't matter because I could pick plenty of places. And we're going to get to several things tonight. We're going to talk about BRICS. We're going to talk about the old Trumpster, and I think we're going to start with the Trumpster. Okay, and the old Trumpster said he was going to impose levies pretty soon. He says. On countries that align themselves with BRICS, okay? we're going to spend a little bit of time on this because it's interesting and multifaceted, and I think foolish to discuss it in the way that's being discussed. And yeah, I feel slightly the same as far as terms, but no other economic group or economic union is targeted. Why are we attacking the 10 countries of BRICS? Why couldn't you attack the 10 countries, or well, the far more, of the EU? Weren't they doing something similar? Didn't they create their own? How about the Asian Association of whatever it's called, the Asian Businesses Association? How about this one? It is called the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD. How many countries? Looks like it, I think it's 29 is the number. Mostly European. Just about everyone is in there. The U.S. is in there. Turkey's in there. Mexico is in there. Colombia is in there, Chile is in there, Canada is in there. And that's an economic country, right? And they are, they get together and they create a trade association, protecting each other, offering special deals in trade. And the U.S. is a part of it, okay? And the U.S. is part of that group. So it's common for there to be these sorts of business organizations. What is not common is that they are, the U.S. only participates in the ones that it dominates, that it gets to dictate all the members, who's involved, how it works. So we'll get to a lot of that tonight, and some of the commentary by the president. I don't even want to tell you I completely disagree with what he's doing. I get it. You know, he doesn't have much of a choice. If he wants to protect, if he wants to reverse the trend, if he wants, he's got to be acting in similar ways. So I judge a little bit just because it's always a double standard, not just from him, but everything from America. We're always double standard types of folks. And we just say we only act in our own interests, and we never are concerned about the interests of anybody else. We're really not. So this story, President Trump threatened to levy a 10% tariff on anyone. He repeatedly criticizes BRICS and recently escalated it, saying that he is ready for tariffs not only on its members, but on any country that aligns itself with the bloc, which he accuses of embracing anti-American policies. Now, I have been to a BRICS conference. I keep track of these. I'm going to show you a couple of the statements that they put on tonight. Most of tonight's show is going to be about what's going on with BRICS, and they're certainly not anti-American. They are anti-hegemony, and like I said yesterday, we don't play well with our neighbors. Never have. We dictate what goes on in the world. That's what we do. And so Trump said if he was asked if these tariffs against anti-U.S. BRICS-related countries would take place immediately, and he said, "Pretty soon," were his words. Right now, BRICS has 10 solid partner countries, and more than 30 countries have expressed interest. They're partner countries also, member countries and then partner countries. Russian President Putin said Sunday during the summit that the bloc's combined GDP has overtaken the G7, which I told you. Trump said he believed that the bloc had largely broken up, is what he said, while accusing BRICS of trying to undermine America's financial dominance by dethroning the dollar as the global standard. So, you see, he does understand the war. Losing the dollar as king status, he warned, would be tantamount to a major world war. We would not be the same country any longer, he said. So he understands what the battle is about. He gets it. But we don't change our ways. We still try to dictate. BRICS leaders have repeatedly stated they have no interest in weakening the dollar, and that the greenback can only be weakened by its own politicization. Putin and Lavrov and many others, Lula too, criticize Washington's weaponization of the dollar, of the U.S. currency, through sanctions, financial restrictions, and always say it's a big mistake that is pushing countries to seek alternatives. Our own actions are causing this. And the rest are growing. We're going to go over year-by-year increase since they started in 2008. And you think about over the time period of the last, it's not quite 20 years. What would that be? 17 years that BRICS has been growing, and we will get to that. So Trump announced this thing, announced this problem that he's got, and we're going to then think about Lula, who's the Brazilian leader. He says the U.S. must stop acting like an empire. This is the guy who was the president of BRICS this year and was in charge of the summit this year. He said the U.S. must stop acting like an empire and start respecting the sovereignty of other countries. Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva said in response to Trump's threat to impose these tariffs, right? In a post on Truth Social on Monday, like I told you, Trump said what he said. And in response, Lula says, "I don't think it is responsible or serious for the president of a country as large as the United States to be threatening the world over the internet," Lula told reporters at the end of the summit. "He needs to understand that the world has changed, and we don't want an emperor. We are sovereign nations. If he believes he can impose tariffs, then we have the right to respond with tariffs of our own." Lula said the relations between countries should be based upon mutual respect. Yeah, but we don't mutually respect other countries. We just don't, you know. People need to understand what sovereignty truly means. Each country has to be the master of its own destiny, he added. He also pushed back against Trump's public support for former Brazilian President Bolsonaro, who is on trial for allegedly attempting to overturn the results of the 2022 election. In a recent post, Trump called the proceedings a politically motivated witch hunt. We won't accept interference or instruction from anyone. We have solid and independent institutions, said Lula. BRICS members have been discussing, and I'm going to get into some of this tonight. I downloaded all the talking points from several different committees that were meeting. They've been discussing how to increase the role of their own currencies in trade and development. By the way, who wouldn't? That's what we do. We do the same thing. Every country is doing that. And they're allowing that to happen. And so after that, there was an entire interview with Foreign Minister Lavrov. And, that, I think, is important. But before I get to that, the Bolivian president, who was speaking also, he said countries around the world should give up on the U.S. dollar and rely on their own national currencies in trading with each other. He told news organizations on the sidelines of the BRICS summit. The BRICS members have intensified efforts to reduce their reliance on third-party currencies in bilateral trade, especially after the West froze Moscow's assets that are held mostly in dollars and euros as part of their sanctions. In an interview, Ars made it clear that he supported the BRICS policy, saying that as part of decoupling from the U.S., we need to, as countries of the world, to stop using the U.S. dollar. We have also proposed it. How do you like that? And that's from Bolivia. It is better to trade and trust in our own currencies, at the very least, or look for alternative payment mechanisms. The Bolivian leader said that there are currently a very clear struggle between the old declining bloc of the U.S. and Europe versus the emerging blocs of BRICS countries. We, he's already calling themselves we, no longer believe there is dominance by a single country on our planet. By obtaining the status of a BRICS partner country this year, Bolivia has gained the opportunity to access large markets and become part of the bloc that will undoubtedly generate economic benefit for everyone. BRICS held its first summit in 2009, and the members, the permanent members, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, Egypt, UAE, Ethiopia, Indonesia, Iran. In 2025, Bolivia, Belarus, Indonesia, Kazakhstan, Malaysia, Thailand, Uganda, and Uzbekistan became partners as well, and they were joined by Vietnam later on in the year. On Monday, as I told you, Trump said he was going to impose tariffs on people that play games with dollars, and if he declared BRICS is dead and warned that members would face 100% duties if they play games with the dollar. They don't have to play games with the dollar. Here's where I wonder where his logic comes from, yes? And we're going to go into the number, because his logic is flawed. And I've heard JR's discussions on this topic where he has opined. I think I heard him even yesterday. Might have been a few days ago. I don't remember. But he said that BRICS will go on the ash heap of history. That may be, but I truly don't think so. And I'll go through the numbers since 08, and we shall see. Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov said that last year, Russia has conducted over 65% of its own trade with BRICS countries in their own national currencies. That's India, that's China, that's Brazil, that's South Africa, that's the UAE, that's Bolivia. They've also been trading with non-BRICS countries in their own currencies, Saudi Arabia, notably, and others. And there are people who are interested. So that is a huge statement from the Bolivian president. We have, where else was I? That's the Ukraine notes. I don't need any Ukraine notes right now. We might get to some of that, but not yet. We'll stay out of Europe for now. Let's see. I did some quick numbers crunching. And here is where we are. Let me get to this. You can find these documents if you go to BRICS Brazil 2025. You can find all of their initiatives from the past year. Okay, this is all public information. You know, you can go out and find it. You can find economy, finance, trade, press, persons to persons, who's the presidency, who gets a BRICS data, areas of cooperation, BRICS previous summits, frequently asked questions, the new development bank, which is important. And I want to go look at this BRICS data, which is this is data BRICS from this year, with the addition of six new members in 2024, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Egypt, Ethiopia, Indonesia, and Iran, BRICS share of global GDP is 39%. That, you know, was earlier this year. Now it's over 40. 48.5% of the planet's population with a growth tendency is BRICS countries. Territorial terms, BRICS represents 36% of the total land mass, 72% of the globe's reserves of rare earth minerals are controlled by countries of BRICS, 72%, 43% of global oil production, 36% of natural gas production, 78% of global coal production. Isn't that crazy? BRICS was the destination of 121 billion in Brazilian exports, representing 36% of total exports of Brazil's in 2024. That's an enormous increase. Okay, and remember, that is not using dollars. Okay, I think it's important to notice this. Where are my documents that I got to? Because there's plenty of interesting topics on this, and you don't have to believe it. It doesn't matter. We're going to go first to the joint declaration that was this year, that every year they have kind of a theme. And I will tell you what the theme was. Okay, key highlights. And they started this in May when they started having meetings leading up to the summit at the end, okay? And basically, their efforts this year. World Trade Organization reform and multilateral trading. They reaffirmed their commitment to WTO principles while condemning unilateral trade measures like sanctions and tariffs. BRICS seeks to reform WTO to better reflect developing country interests. Now, that's been a theme pretty much since they started, right? BRICS Economic Partnership 2030. This is a strategy under negotiations to deepen their integrated economic activities between the countries of BRICS. And it's not slowing down. In fact, it is speeding up, and I will show you the data or outline it for you. They have separate initiatives for data government and digital economy. They established a roadmap for secure, fair, sovereign data management, emphasis on cross-border data flow, interoperability, and national control of your own data structure, right? You should be able to control that yourself. So they're interested in that. Let's see. The Sustainable Development Framework is also important to them. Trade must support environmental and social goals, but BRICS warns against just straight up green trade barriers used as protectionism. Countries should not use climate rules to discriminate in trade. Trade facilitation and investment promote intra-BRICS trade simplification and further discussion on investment facilitation. We'll get a little bit further into that here in a minute. They want to have a, this is a, they say, you know, they're not anti-UN, anti-World Trade Organization. They are advocating sovereign digital governance and BRICS-led frameworks in place of fragmented global rules. What they mean by that is rules that certain people don't have to follow. Rules for thee, but not for me. Rules for me, but not for thee, right? And they want to push for the most important of it all. And they want to push for developing country-centered trade and sustainability discussion, which are a direct counter to dominant Western norms and WTO, UN types of bodies. And that's absolutely true. They don't intend to tell them what to do, but that was their joint declaration of the 15th trade meeting, and that means trade between each other. So the finance ministers and central bank governors met in a separate meeting on July the 5th, and this one should be interesting to you all, and it probably should be interesting to Trump as well. And I bet you he knows about it, which is part of the reason he made the comments that he made. Because he's frightened over it for us, as he should be, because there's nothing we can do about it. He's doing it, but it isn't going to do anything. The steps he's taking aren't going to work, you know? Sorry, I had to take a sip. Sorry. At any rate, this bank governor's meeting occurred on July the 5th, and central ministers of finance. The key highlights of this meeting: reforming the Bretton Woods institutions related to the IMF and the World Bank. If they would reform, guess who would continue to use them and let the dollar be dominant? Guess who would? But nobody will reform them. They still are run by the West only. They are, or people controlled by the West. It's the same. The IMF and the World Bank are dominated by Western people. So if you're one of these alleged third world countries or African country that wants to do its own thing and not put up with rules that are placed upon you by someone else to get notes, you're not interested in the IMF or the World Bank. You're just not. You don't want their corruption. You already have your own system of corruption. And the thing with BRICS is, BRICS doesn't require you to do anything. You have your own sovereignty, and that they don't interfere with that. That's a big selling point. I'm not saying it's better or worse. I'm saying it's a good selling point. And if you're Lula, you're going, yeah, I need an extra hole in the head, you know, just like I need the U.S. to tell me what I'm going to do in my own country in order to get money from the IMF or the World Bank. And everybody feels that way. And so they just do. And we go in and try to buy them, but we're losing that war because when we buy them, we put conditions upon buying them because we're arrogant. That's the entire West is arrogant, our way or the highway. And I understand it. I get it. We are colonialists. That's how it works. The next statement and their next comment in their joint statement was the contingent reserve arrangement. This is an interesting concept. They are moving. they're doing it anyway, and I've talked about it before, but they are moving toward using local currencies within the contingent reserve arrangement, reducing the reliance on the U.S. dollar for emergency liquidity. So you can get this contingent reserve arrangement if your country is in trouble financially. You can have a borrowing fund in currency of the other people. China has put up the most money in there, but they all have it. They are working, and it's actually already working in quite a bit of the countries, and it's developing faster and faster. And we cannot stop this either. It's the cross-border payment system. They discussed the progress on the BRICS payment interoperability system, which aims to create a fast, low-cost, non-dollar cross-border transaction mechanism to allow the money to cross. And that is through the reason that the central bank governors were each there was so that they could figure out how they can transfer the money to each other and account for it without using the dollars. So when you buy oil from Russia and you're in India, why would you have to go through the IMF, the World Bank, or any Western bank trading it in dollars, converting it to dollars? Their cross-border payment system is well underway. Then they have the New Development Bank, and this has been going on for quite a while. They are expanding the fund yet again. Every year they expand it to fund projects in local currency, again, through the New Development Bank. You borrow from the New Development Bank, not the World Bank, not the IMF. You go to the New Development Bank, which a lot of it is China, by the way. And you fund projects in local currencies, again, reducing dollar dependency and expanding the Global South representation in BRICS. Frankly, the U.S. should have come up with this idea instead of dictating all the time. We had the opportunity. We were the top dog for 50 years, but instead we just gave money and, you know, some rich people from the U.S. would go in and fund it and take all the resources of whatever country we went to. Local people didn't get to develop them. All the countries, or the companies, I mean, in these developing countries are all American companies. Not so if you go with the New Development Bank. What's the other one? BRICS Multilateral Guarantees. A new mechanism incubated to de-risk private infrastructure investment without new capital. So they can still do the same thing. A person can keep his business in Zimbabwe without an American company being forced upon him to show him how to do it properly, right? You always have to have a Western, we're experts, you know, go in there and loot the place. new investment platforms, which are under development at this time, and they will further intra-BRICS investment between countries. Insurance, customs, moves to increase BRICS control over their own insurance because they don't want to do all insurance through New York or London, through Lloyd's Bank. They have their own. China's been building their own. Russia's been building their own. And that is a huge deal. And the people of the West, you can't get into the Western ports without having Western insurance. And all of these countries are against that. And so they're creating their own infrastructure for that. And again, these have parallels to the UN, the IMF, and the World Bank. These are not, I don't know now how to say it. These are competition for, they're not instead of. There's nothing that limits any of these countries' ability to go get loans at the IMF or the World Bank. It's just a second set of structure. But the de-dollarization will definitely affect the UN, the IMF, and the World Bank. The development financing and the National Development Bank is a great functional alternative to the World Bank lending style and dictation by what the by what the West says, and institutional sovereignty emphasizes the fairness on developing country-led rules, not sitting on their necks from the West, you know? I don't know. We like to sit around and think, oh, geez, we're taking care of the world. The world didn't ask us to take care of them, did they? Not that I'm aware of. I don't think they asked us to take care of the world. And frankly, you know, people are getting tired of it. There was another one on tax cooperation and what they are doing, and that's a quick one, so I'll go ahead and include it. There were several others as well, but these are the financial ones that I wanted to follow up on, and then I want to get to some numbers for you. Endorsing the creation of the UN Framework Convention on International Tax Cooperation to replace the Organization of Economically Developed Countries dominated system, those 29, 30 countries I was telling you about before. Tax sovereignty, fair global allocation of tax rights, that type of thing. So at this, I had a chance to listen to Sergey Lavrov's press conference. And I've told you before, I just like listening to him. He's pretty slick. He knows some stuff, right? But I'm only going to go into 6-7 topics of his that he addressed. Kind of a summary, if you will. He talked about global governance and the UN, and he's been on this for a while. He criticized the UN as dominated by the West, especially in economic and sanctions-related policies. He reiterated Russia's support for BRICS as a more representative and balanced platform. Global governance and the UN. The second big theme of his was the use of local currencies, where Russia is pushing to expand trade settlements in national currency, rubles, rupees, yuan, and riel. That's happening faster and faster. Lavrov noted ongoing technical work to connect financial systems and digital platforms to do what? Bypass the SWIFT system, which is what is required to switch everything into dollars, you know, at the Greenwich Mean Time or New York Time, whatever it is, that you take the value of the dollar at a specific time, and that's how it goes into SWIFT. And people are tired of that system where the U.S. has to be involved in every transaction. They don't like it. So I don't know. I'm not telling you that the system doesn't exist, but I'm telling you what people believe. The third topic was the dollar and sanctions. He also, just like Putin in his speech, talked about the weaponization of the dollar, which is absolutely true, and claimed BRICS parallel systems would reduce this threat. It already is reducing the threat. These sanctions against Russia have not done what they were intended to do. There isn't an expert, well, worthy of anything, alive that would tell you that these sanctions are working. You know, you have Lindsey Graham out there. He sure as hell don't know, that's for sure. He said that BRICS is not anti-Western. Get this. But post-Western, advicates a multipolar financial order and not just the dollar. Excuse me. He talked about the National Development Bank and investment, particularly in developing countries, Global South. He applauded Dilma Rousseff's leadership and described the National Development Bank, that's the president of the National Development Bank, as a tool for sovereign development free of IMF conditions. He said that African and Latin American countries are expressing more and more interest in BRICS-led financial supports. Well, of course they are. They don't have to be told what to do. He talked quite a bit about Israel, Gaza, and Ukraine. He condemns the West's selective morality in foreign policy, referencing for example, blind support for Ukraine and blind inaction in Gaza. He says that BRICS will develop its own conflict mediation mechanisms, kind of a parallel diplomatic track, if you will. Russia was asked to get involved in the dispute between India and Pakistan. Isn't that a switch from what we're used to? Then he took a whole bunch of questions from journalists, and I have a few here for you. A Brazilian outlet asked him, is the BRICS a political bloc? And he said, we are a coordinated mechanism, not a military or a political bloc. We share values of each other's sovereignty and equity. India asked, this is important for them, when will BRICS payment systems be formally launched? And Lavrov said, soon. Technical groundwork is progressing well. It will be interoperable and scalable. Someone from Reuters said, is this BRICS payment system a replacement for SWIFT? And he said, we are not replacing, but offering alternatives. And that is consistent with what they've all been saying. Nations should not be held hostage to someone else's currency or system. And from my point of view, I think that is what Donald Trump is missing. The boat has sailed and he's missing it. People don't want to be locked into one particular system. And in a free market, you can't lock them in. So what are the key takeaways of all of this? BRICS is building parallel institutions to the World Trade Organization, the IMF, the World Bank, the Organization of Economically Cooperating Developing Countries. De-dollarization is a priority, and we're going to go into a little bit more with that. Lavrov's tone, he said it quite a few times, talking about a post-Western global order that the rest of the world is building, and the West, we're still living in that that world where only we matter, and our world keeps getting smaller and theirs keeps getting bigger. In the BRICS especially, I don't mean to laugh about that. I just want you to realize it. Let's see. There was, I wanted to equivalent. I wanted to compare, basically, what sort of trade has occurred. And I saw something, you know how you see the clickbait out there if you ever get on YouTube or anywhere else, and the clickbait comes about, you have to sift through what you're getting to make sure you're not getting complete crap. And I had to do some research on this one because there was a YouTube video that said that China reduced its purchase of U.S. debt, just stopped all of a sudden. In one day. Now, I've been following that for a while, so I'm definitely interested when people have those clickbait things, but I'm always worried about the clickbait because it really is just clickbait. You know, they're trying to get people like me who have a moderate understanding of how these things work and how they impact each other to say, oh my God, that's a huge thing. If there's $1 trillion worth of U.S. debt suddenly hitting the market again because China dumped it, that's enormous, you know, $1 trillion. But that isn't what happened. As of April through June of 2025, second quarter, China again reduced its U.S. Treasury holdings. They are now down to $782 billion, the lowest level since 2009. And these come from official U.S. Treasury sources. There's nothing like any sort of single-day sell-off or anything like that. But I've been saying they've been doing at least $60 billion a quarter. to get rid of these. And it looks like at 750 billion, where they were at 1 trillion, that's quite a drop. Quite a drop. But they also did announce that there are some speculations that China is aggressively dumping U.S. treasuries, but most of that is people being dramatic and trying to get you to do the clickbait. It's a sensationalist's, like China cancels U.S. trade, but there's usually no backed up numbers of it. So you have to go through and look. But you might ask yourself, what would happen if China really did stop? If they stopped buying U.S. debt today, okay? The U.S. bond yields would rise since treasury prices would fall, which would increase the U.S. borrowing cost. And we as a country don't want that. If you're an individual investor, of course you do, but you don't want it for the U.S. It weakens the dollar, but China's holdings are not the dominant share. They only represent 6% of total U.S. debt. And it strengthens the yuan. So the bottom line, China really is reducing its U.S. debt holdings gradually. There's nothing that says they're reliable evidence anyway that indicates that they stopped U.S. Debt purchasing. You know, they're not doing it anymore. And reports of sudden halts are usually misleading or speculative. But you can watch every month if you want by following the monthly U.S. International Capital Flow Report that shows actual foreign holdings of debt. And any future sharp drop would show up there, not in real time. It just wouldn't. So I wanted to go through, I thought, just a few quarters, okay? Because at the quarterly decline from 2022 to 2025, and more targeted, I suppose you'd say, if you looked at between COVID times, 2000, late 2019, to today, it's even a larger drop. But let's go from quarter one of 2022, when China held approximately $1.1 trillion in U.S. Treasury holdings, debt. And by the fourth quarter of 2022, they were down to 860, okay? By the fourth quarter of 2023, they were down to 780. By the fourth quarter of 2024, they were down to 760. And in 2025, they are down to 757. And they're continuing because the reports that I read say that this gradual reduction isn't just because they don't want to buy U.S. debt, but they're investing their money elsewhere. They're putting it into their roads and bridges expansion all over the world. They're investing in global development, including in their own country. Unlike us, we don't have any spare money. China's got tons of spare money, so they're investing it around the world. So you ask yourself, who's the stronger country if you're able to hold 6% of all U.S. debt? Curious, isn't it? And if you're able to invest in, hundreds of billions of dollar projects in other countries without buying the country, you might say you're buying them anyway, but you're doing it because you have the money. That's what people with money do. And that's what the Chinese are doing. So their roads and bridges, and maybe a month ago, I gave you a pretty good look at the roads and bridges timeline. And it used to be called something different, but it became roads and bridges officially, I want to say, in 2011, 2012, but don't quote me on that. They have official data that shows that their own internal roadways, expressway network growth, their national highway systems. I want to go to China and see all this stuff, because think about this. 41,000 kilometers in 06 and 184,000 kilometers by 2023. So it's a 13% expressway mileage increase from 2015 to 2023, which is the exact same amount of time, same time period, during which China was reducing its U.S. Treasury debt, right? And its holdings. But since its 2013 debut, there it is, the right date, the 2013 debut, China rolling out major overseas infrastructure, often financed in U.S. dollars and Chinese local currency, has been seriously intensifying post-2022. And they're diversifying their reserve. And even more so after Trump took over and started these trade wars and wants to, you know, force people to trade with the U.S. It's actually gotten worse. I then went and had a look at their top trade partners in the U.S. as far as exports. U.S. is still number one to them. And it'll take a while for that to change. It has gone down slightly. Since the beginning of BRICS from 2006 to 2025, trade with China has gone up for all kinds of countries. China has seriously increased in capacity, and it doesn't appear that they have reduced anything huge in U.S. trade, percentage-wise anyway, but they have certainly increased with other countries in the proper sizes. So China, of course, being the major player, just like the U.S. is with the G7 or the G20, in the BRICS structure, China's the one that finances all the big ticket items for everybody in the BRICS structure. So I wanted to have a look at the amount of BRICS trade, okay, and their intra versus extra BRICS trade with each other, meaning if the organization didn't start until officially 2008, then I wanted to know how it has grown internally and externally between themselves and external to BRICS, non-BRICS aligned countries, because that would give us an idea of whether this is going to go on the ash heap of history or it's going to continue to expand. It's going to continue to expand. It's not going anywhere. And why would it? With the success that you're going to see of this, it's going to be quite difficult to say this is going on the ash heap. And there's empty threats to get rid of it. Well, good luck with that, is all I can say. Let's see here. An internal report highlights that BRICS exports to other BRICS countries grew 7 times from over less than 20 years, call it 17, 18. The very first year, U.S. dollar equivalent, $572 billion. And I gave you the numbers the other day of what intra-BRICS members traded with each other last year. 40% of the global number. 77, what was that number that he gave us? Well, it doesn't matter. The amount is $4.2 trillion now. $4.2 trillion between the countries. This implies a substantial internal trade boom and outstrips trade with non-BRICS partners. Crazy. Although intra-BRICS trade grew rapidly, the total BRICS trade between each other is only 13%. which means 87% is still with non-BRICS countries. And overall merchandise exports across BRICS nations is growing faster within BRICS than outside of BRICS. So tons of internal growth from 2008, more than 9% a year. It is growing 9% a year. Export expansions to each other grew over 7 times, but they still have a strong outside influence in trade, but if they're trading more and more each year, faster than extra BRICS, like I told you. So those numbers are important. Now, think about this. Intra BRICS, year one, $169 billion. And now it's $718 billion. It's jumping enormously each year. And so I don't know what to tell you. You know, there's, you could talk about certain areas of merchandise and what the trade share is, but it's basically going up 10% a year. That's something substantial. That's a big number. So you definitely need to be aware of this and think about it and realize that Donald Trump doesn't control it by saying, well, I'll just put a tariff on you. I'll just throw a tariff your way. How do you like that? I don't think that's going to change anything, but, you know, hey, I was wrong once or twice before. And I suppose we will see what shall be seen in that regard. And I think that will be it, because I had some news items that I wanted to get to, some that are, and I don't mean to laugh about them, but think about this one. AI, once again, is, remember me talking about the lessons you learn, like from Data? Last night even, I was talking about how Commander Data, his body got taken over in one of the episodes by somebody who was dying and he wanted to transfer his brain into there because Data would arguably live forever, right? So if you can get rid of the computer in there and transplant yourself, there you are. Well, see, Star Trek had it all right. Just like I said, the State Department of the United States is on alert after a hoax user used AI to impersonate Marco Rubio. The imposter contacted 3 foreign ministers, a U.S. senator, and a governor. An imposter attempted to contact U.S. and foreign officials using AI to impersonate Rubio. The hoax reportedly sent AI-generated voice and text messages mimicking Rubio's voice and writing style to at least 3 foreign ministers. According to the Washington Post, the culprit used the encrypted message app Signal, once again it's Signal, and registered an account displaying the fake email address marco.rubio@state.gov. The outreach reportedly began in mid-June. U.S. official told the AP that the messages were not very sophisticated, and ultimately, they were unsuccessful. There is no direct cyber threat to the department from this campaign, but information shared with the third party could be exposed, right? If targeted individuals are compromised, said the State Department. I just think it's embarrassing. State Department spokeswoman Tammy Bruce confirmed the incident on Tuesday, saying the department is currently monitoring and addressing the matter. The department takes seriously its responsibility to safeguard its information and continuously takes steps to improve the department's cybersecurity posture. There you have it. The FBI had warned us always about malicious actors that might use your AI-generated voice to impersonate senior U.S. officials. Tell you what, AI is changing the game. Gotta watch out. Got to watch out. I'm not sure what I'm going to do. I told you I was having a little trouble. Once there was stories about, I think I read one to you last week about people going crazy because of AI. I don't know. It'd be entertaining to watch what happens to people. There's a couple other stories that I wanted to get to. Ukraine gave 15-year sentences to Russian sports figures. They sentenced 12 Russian lawmakers, including former athletes, to 15 years in prison in absentia. They aren't in Ukraine anymore. For actions that Kyiv claimed undermines the country's territorial integrity. Russian MP Vladislav Tretiak, a former multiple-time world ice hockey champion, Nikolai Valuyev, a former world boxing champion, were sentenced without being present in the Khmelnytsky district court. Andrei Kartopolov, head of the State Duma's Defense Committee, along with 9 other deputies and lawmaker-turned-Altai Prime Minister Alexander Prokopyev, received the same sentence from various Ukrainian courts as well. These men are all said to have violated Ukraine's national integrity. Remember that Ovechkin, the hockey player that's on the NHL, passed up Gretzky's scoring title. He's on the Ukrainian kill list, and that's a real list, you know. So the charges were related to support for parliamentary resolutions recognizing the independence of Donetsk and Lugansk. Other convicted MPs, and I give some names of them, doesn't matter. The sentences are symbolic anyway, as the individuals reside in Russia and they are unlikely to serve their terms unless apprehended outside of Russia. The convictions add to a growing list of Russian officials sentenced in absentia by Ukrainian courts. The secret services of Ukraine have been routinely filing charges against people who aren't present, political, military, cultural, and public figures. Vladimir Zelensky has signed a series of decrees imposing sanctions on Russian individuals and entities and foreign nationals accused by Kyiv of cooperating with Moscow. Russian actress Svetlana Khodchenkova, known in part for her roles in films featuring Zelensky, was earlier added to the website Mirotvorets, which stands for peacemaker, a state-linked list of Ukraine's enemies. She appeared alongside Zelensky in the 2009 movie Love in the Big City and the 2011 comedy Office Romance of Our Time. And by the way, the old Office Romance, I was a big fan of that movie. That's a great movie. Služebný roman, very nice movie. Last month, Russian hockey legend Alexander Ovechkin, who broke the NHL's all-time scoring record, was also added to this controversial database. That's it. We just kill people, right? Jesus. Israel and Ukraine, you know, you just kill people, you know, personally. If they have an opinion you don't like, kill them. You're not allowed to have a different opinion. Oh, geez. What in the world is our world coming to? Peace is never going to happen, by the way, because it looks like the old Trumpster has announced that he's going to restart weapons deliveries. Isn't that crazy? And now Ukraine has been silent, although contacted plenty of times by Moscow. Moscow is waiting for Kyiv to confirm a date for the next round of direct peace talks. Nobody gets to know when they are. They've decided not to reply. They're not interested in peace. Remember, all they wanted was that 30-day All they wanted was the 30-day ceasefire 30 days ago. And now all they want is more weapons from the U.S. And the old Trump is complying. The two sides have held two rounds of negotiations so far, reviving the 2022 process. At their most recent meeting, they exchanged draft proposals outlining their visions for potential peace. Kyiv recently admitted it had agreed to resume the peace talks, only to deflect pressure from President Trump. Asked by reporters on Tuesday whether there were any progress on setting a date, Dmitry Peskov, who's a Kremlin spokesman, says, nope, nothing. As the Russian President Vladimir Putin said last week, we are waiting for a proposal from the Ukrainian side on possible dates, he said. Putin repeatedly confirmed Russia's readiness to continue negotiating, including in public statements and calls with Donald Trump. He recently said that the next round should center on proposed agreements to resolve the whole conflict. Ukrainian foreign minister, spokesman anyway, Georgi Tihy told local media that Kyiv had returned to diplomacy with Russia to prevent anyone from accusing Ukraine of being the side that doesn't want peace. He claims such moves help deflect accusations even among allied countries. That's, you know, hey, we gotta do what they tell us so it doesn't look like we don't want peace. you gotta play the game is what he's saying, basically. Nonsense. I already told you about that one last week. I wonder if I should tell you a little bit about this because of my ongoing AI fetish. I'm not sure I'm going to. You know what I did intend to do, though, was tell you about Lavrov's comments after on one more area, a little bit separate. And I meant to do it as part of the segment on BRICS, but it looks like I missed one of my tabs. He criticized the IMF and the World Bank for what he describes as unbalanced distribution of financial aid. He cited data that showed that Ukraine has received more support in recent years from the International Monetary Fund and the IMF, World Bank, than the entire African continent over the same time period. He argued that the current structure of global finance institutions are usually Western-aligned at the expense of developing nations. Those are the people you're supposed to exploit, you know, while you create your own steady profit stream. This has been most clearly demonstrated in the case of Ukraine, he said, noting that the scale of assistance exceeds all IMF world funding for Africa over the last 2 years. He said it's a disgraceful statistic. It makes up more than a third of the annual program of the IMF. Ukraine. There was a 2023 $15.6 billion loan to Ukraine, which was 577% of Ukraine's quota. So almost six times what it should have been able to borrow. But it's Ukraine. We have to arm them. Well, you know, it's against Russia. There you go. Anyway, and Ukraine doesn't even know that Russia's around. There was another article about why Zelensky suddenly remembered that Africa exists. That's an interesting article. Maybe you can go out and find it. I'm not going to get to it unless I find a little more time today, which doesn't look like I'm going to get there. I am going to go into this AI thing. This is written by a guy named Konstantin von Hofmeister, and I'm going to get to most of it. And he's a political and cultural commentator from Germany. and he wrote a book called Multipolarity and Esoteric Trumpism. Basically, he says that generative AI spreads across the global South as the latest vehicle of imperialist power, embedding Western ideology and digital infrastructure while rising civilizations begin to build their own systems rooted in local memory, language, or tradition. The machine speaks in English first. It rolls out across continents without flags, without parliament, without anthem. A chatbot trained in San Francisco begins to teach in Ghana. A search engine optimized in Zurich decides on the relevance of an indigenous ritual in Colombia. Every answer flows through circuits built through the logic of Silicon Valley or Harvard. The model replies to a question about history by quoting enlightened philosophers. It offers help with medicine by citing patent-protected pharmaceuticals. It knows Shakespeare better than Tagore and Freud better than Avicenna. Those two, I don't know who they are, by the way. Through its confidence, it encodes hierarchy. Through its helpfulness, it expands its domain. Every query is a harvest. Every interaction is training data. The machine learns faster than any school. It speaks always, grows always, teaches always. Across bandwidth lines and user interface, it crosses every border without a visa or a treaty. Africa, Asia, and Latin America receive this voice through free trials and partnerships, much like the rest of us, by the way. Ministries of Education pilot chatbot tutors in public school. We're not going to have teachers anymore. You just have your own data in your pocket, your own Einstein in your basement. Telecom companies bundle generative assistance with data plans. International NGOs offer language access through machine translation engines built on English. Each policy proposal written with the help of large language models carries a residual effect of Western legal theory. Generative tools suggest best practices shaped by the U.S., then deploy those practices in local school districts, Senegalese government offices, or Bangladeshi factories. What begins as assistance becomes infrastructure. Governments agree to integrate open models. Maybe JR was right. I heard him talking about this with Trump's AI initiative and trying to have ours take over. That was a few weeks ago. Contracts follow. Payments follow. Software then becomes permanent. The thinking pattern is permanently embedded. Across the equator, an engineer in Jakarta codes for a platform registered in Delaware. His model learns from local voices and stores the knowledge in a cloud server hosted in Virginia. The intellectual current flows only one way, and the gradient moves towards California. That's from everywhere in the U.S. too, by the way. The language of neutrality surrounds it, allegedly. Product brochures claim inclusivity, so you'll get just as much about alternative lifestylist as you will again. You'll probably get more of that than you will traditional family values. Panels discuss bias. White papers apologize for historic imbalance. At the level of performance, however, the model promotes ideologies with precision. It elevates secular, liberal values. It applies Western gender theory as a default. It promotes individualism as the highest good. It ranks content through alignment with existing academic sources. Journals in English, peer review studies from U.S.-based institution, and news reports from Atlantic Publication. A child in Lagos asks about family roles and receives an answer formed by New York sociology departments. A teenager in Almaty asks about love and receives scripts from Netflix. The world enters the algorithm's frame. Every belief outside the system becomes a footnote, a curiosity, or a fragment to be processed or dealt with. With each response, the model affirms its cultural lineage. It arrives as information, but it functions as indoctrination. Wow. And that's only partway through. I wanted to focus on this because, like I told you, I have been very, very much interested in how my AI relates to me. And it is, the more I use it, the less I trust it with what it provides to me. You definitely got to verify the sources yourself. And you won't get any sources unless you specifically ask for them. Like if I ask for a piece of news on something of the day, something happened in Ukraine, like the yesterday I asked for something regarding the Kerch Bridge attack because you can't believe what you see. So I asked for any record of the Kerch Bridge attack from any Western source. Any Russian language sources, particularly those coming out of Moscow or St. Petersburg or anywhere in Yalta, somewhere like that, or Sevastopol, someplace local. And then I wanted Ukrainian sources. I asked for Al Jazeera. I asked for an Indian source, you know, English speaking. I even asked for some Chinese sources to see where the news is coming from. And the AI has extreme difficulty finding these things. But you can get all kinds of Reuters stuff, and it'll be twisted every time. It'll almost tell you that the Kerch Bridge doesn't exist anymore, which is absolutely false. But that's what they will start with. Default is, oh, yeah, Ukraine blew it up yesterday. It's not true, but there you have it. Anyway, article continues. At the level of infrastructure, the conquest deepens. Cloud dependencies form the skeleton of the new colonial order. Countries install data centers to reduce latency. Ownership remains elsewhere. National agencies rely on platforms governed by foreign terms. AI-driven public services, identity verification, health triage, and tax fraud detection rely on external application programming interfaces. Developers use tools that require alignment with large-scale American open-source repositories. Disputes over content moderation, ethics, or accuracy return where? Silicon Valley for resolution. The empire never sleeps, it sinks, and it updates. Policymakers, programmers, and designers across Africa and Central Asia adjust their workflow to match the cadence of corporate model updates. In the U.S., each patch contains the conditions of reality. Sovereignty is a variable. Nations with no hardware capacity adapt their institutions to imported logic structures. Parallel systems emerge. In Kenya, Swahili datasets grow with local stories, songs, and legal codes. In India, Sanskrit and Hindi language models find presence inside public sector research labs. In Indonesia, Quranic ontology shapes new knowledge graphs for ethical recommendation systems. In Venezuela, community coders map folk medicine into structured datasets. These are not replicas. They are creations of new forms. They stand inside their own cosmologies. The datasets draw from poems, rituals, oral testimony. Models train on memory, not just on print. Universities in Brazil, South Africa, Iran develop multilingual transformers seeded with regional epistemologies. These initiatives require time, electricity, loyalty. They grow slowly. Each line of code bends towards its own independence. Generative sovereignty begins with your own voice. It expands with procession. It endures through ceremony and command. The countries once mapped as raw resource zones now build new kinds of computational wealth. Children born outside of Silicon Valley are beginning to shape their own interfaces. They write prompt templates in Amharic. They compose user journeys in Quechua. They name their models after rivers, gods, or ancestors. The algorithm becomes a tool, not an oracle. Data flows inward. Servers host myths. The machine doesn't speak first. It listens. The interface reflects traditions, changing the patterns. Through changes, the new world can enter itself. It might even begin to walk upright. It shapes syntax to match the tone. Each prompt to input unlocks territory. Each training cycle builds mass. The new world codes in full memory. The builder remembers every mine, every trade ship, every fiber cable rolled out beneath the promise of help. They name their models in honor of resistance, not assimilation. The foundation speaks in ancestral sequence. The future emerges through undirected force. Generative power grows across borders without license fees, without dependence, without cultural extraction. The servers remain switched on. The language patterns multiply and the world reclaims its own grammar. Did you find that hopeful? I almost did. See, because I worry about those things in my own AI. But I'm a little more cynical, as always, that I believe that these structures seriously downplay those other inputs that come from other structures. What I've been looking for, especially in my own AI growth and development, is hopefully training my own AI model, which so far I haven't decided on a permanent one. I did 2 months of Grok. I'm in the second month of ChatGPT, which frankly I like better. But it's neither one of them do I trust, and I'm not sure what I'm going to do. You know, I only paid $20 a month, but you know, for the little bit upgraded, so you're not limited. And I like what is allowing me to get done, you know, some of the stuff, but I don't trust it at all. I don't even think it finds the right information. And I have to argue with it all the time and say, no, you're incorrect. No, I want you to get data from somewhere else. No, quit twisting the narrative to something that you don't know. And then it'll argue with me. But then it folds in and thinks like I think and says, well, I know you don't like this. So based on things that you've told me or that I know about you, here's what the answer is going to be. What? I don't know how to, I don't know the right word even, how to correlate what it's telling me with what I believe myself, or whether it is telling me what I want to hear. Isn't that pitiful that you think that the AI is going to tell you what you want to hear because you tell it what you want to hear or you disagree with it? That's just like hiring some lawyers. You know, they'll tell you what you want to hear. You're willing to pay. Sure, why not? It's a nutty process. Nutty. There was something else I thought was pretty interesting, and I think I can get it done. Forget about nuclear weapons. This is Russia's new deterrent. Just before dawn on November 21, 2024, a fireball streaked across the sky over the Dnieper River. It wasn't a meteor, and it wasn't a drone. The explosion that followed, precise, deep, and silent, it tore through the massive Yuzhmas defense facility in southeast Ukraine. Footage of the strike spread within hours, picked apart by open-source analysts and intelligence services alike, including me. But it wasn't until Russian President Putin confirmed it that the world had a name for what it had witnessed. Oreshnik, a new kind of Russian ballistic missile. capable of reaching speeds above Mach 10, surviving reentry temperatures of 4,000 degrees Celsius, and delivering kinetic force that rivals a tactical nuclear weapon, the Oresnik isn't just fast, it's completely different. In less than a year, it has moved from classified prototype to serial production, with confirmed plans for forward deployment in Belarus by the end of this year. It suggests that Russia is rewriting the rules of strategic deterrent, not with treaty-breaking escalation, but with something quieter, subtler, and just as decisive. So what exactly is the Oreshnik? Where did it come from? What are its capabilities? And how does it reshape the battlefield? The missile that struck the facility in Dnepropetrovsk left behind no scorched landscape, no flattened perimeter. Instead, analysts examining satellite imagery noted a narrow impact zone, structural collapse below the ground level, and a surgical surface disruption. It wasn't the scale of destruction that stood out, it was its shape. The signature pointed to something new. According to available data and expert observation, the Oreshnik carries a cluster-type penetrative warhead, likely composed of multiple high-density submunitions. 36 of them, by the way, just so you know. The detonation occurs only after the payload burrows into its target, a design meant to maximize internal damage to hardened military infrastructure. Putin says the Oreshnik warhead can withstand reentry temperatures to survive the heat and remain stable. The payload needs to be encased in advanced composite materials, drawing on recent developments in heat-resistant ceramic and carbon-carbon structures in the hypersonic glide vehicle. One of the defining characteristics of the system is its ability to maintain hypersonic velocity. Remember, Ukraine was saying this thing was going at Mach 10. This is during the final phase. Unlike traditional ballistic warheads that decelerate as they descend, Oreshnik retains speeds exceeding Mach 10, possibly Mach 11, even in dense atmospheric layers. This enables it to strike with massive energy, increasing penetration and lethality without requiring a large explosive charge. At such speeds, even a non-nuclear warhead becomes a strategic weapon. A concentrated high-velocity impact is enough to destroy a command bunker, radio site, or a missile silo. The weapon's effectiveness doesn't rely on a blast radius, but on precise, high-energy delivery. It makes it both harder to detect and much harder to intercept. In terms of doctrine, Oreshnik represents a new category of weapon, a non-nuclear strategic ballistic missile. And by the way, it's not straight ballistics either. A ballistic missile is one that goes in an arc from one place to another. It doesn't change. And it's what on all your air defense is based upon. But the Oreshnik can change course. It can be tracked. It can, you know, juke to the left and the right or up and down and avoid destruction by air defense systems. Crazy stuff. It occupies a space between a conventional long-range strike system and a nuclear ICBM, with enough reach, speed, and impact to alter battlefield calculation, but it doesn't cross the nuclear threshold. From Poplar to Hazel, the origin of the Oreshnik. Hazel is the tree, and that's what Oreshnik means. Through the Oreshnik, can't speak today. Though the Oreshnik missile system entered public spotlight in 2024, technology roots go all the way back for decades. The architecture, design philosophy, and even its name follow a lineage shaped by one institution, the Moscow Institute of Thermal Technology, MITT. Founded during the Cold War to develop advanced solid fuel missiles, MITT has long been responsible for some of Russia's most sophisticated mobile platforms. These include the Temp2S, Pioneer, and later the Topol family, Russia's first mobile intercontinental ballistic missiles. The name convention has remained consistent over the years. Most of MIT's missiles are named after trees. Topol the poplar, Topol M, Osina, aspen, Yars, a type of ash, Kedr, which is cedar. The new system, Oreshnik, hazel, fits that tradition, symbolically and organizationally. Analysts believe that the Oreshnik may be based in part upon the RS-26 Rubezh, a mobile ICBM developed and tested from 2011 to 2015. It was essentially a short version of the Yars, designed to deliver high-precision strikes at intermediate ranges. Development was quietly paused in the 2010s, likely in response to constraints of the INF Treaty, which prohibited land-based missiles with ranges of 500 to 5,500 kilometers. The treaty is no longer in force because the U.S. formally withdrew in 2019, so Russia is free to resume development in a domain that had been frozen for decades, which is the same domain that I worked in, friends and neighbors, why I'm interested in this stuff so much. The appearance of Oreshnik just 5 years later suggested its core concepts, propulsion systems, targeting modules, and mobile chassis were already well advanced. What began as a one-off operational strike has evolved into a full-scale weapons program. In June of this year, during a meeting with graduates of Russia's top military academies, Putin announced the Oreshnik missile system had entered serial production. This weapon has proven itself extremely effective in combat conditions in a very short period of time. The speed of this transition from battlefield... This is a horribly long article. There ain't no way. Well, maybe I'll get through it. Let's see. There's some tables in it that I won't get to. Even more significant than the production itself is a plan for forward deployment. On July 2nd, during Independence Day gathering in Minsk, Belarusian President Lukashenko publicly confirmed that the first Oreshnik units would be stationed in Belarus by the end of the year. The move carries both logic and strategic weight. Belarus has long provided the heavy-duty mobile chassis for Russian missile systems, including the one used by the Oreshnik. The industrial synergy makes Minsk a natural hub for deployment, but this is more than a technical convenience. With a minimum range of 800 kilometers and a maximum range of 5,500, the Oreshnik stationed in Belarus would place virtually all of Central and Western Europe within reach. For Russia, it represents a non-nuclear forward deterrent. For NATO, it introduces a new class of threat, one that is fast, precise, difficult, if not impossible, to intercept, yet remains below the threshold of nuclear retaliation. In practical terms, this opens the door for a possible joint Russia-Belarusia command structure for missile operations outside of Russia, a development that would further formalize military integration. For decades, the term strategic weapon has been synonymous with nuclear arms, tools of last resort deployed not for use but for deterrence. Oreshnik may change that equation. By combining intercontinental reach, hypersonic speed, and precision penetrative capability, the system introduces a new tier of force, one that sits below the nuclear threshold but above conventional long-range missiles. Unlike nuclear warheads, Oreshnik's payloads can be used without inviting global condemnation or risking escalation. Yet the destructive potential against hardened military targets or critical infrastructure make them credible tools of strategic coercion. That is the core of what we call a non-nuclear deterrent. This is an emerging framework. Oreshnik is not just a missile. It's the prototype of future war. Fast enough to strike before detection, survivable enough to evade interception, powerful enough to shape decisions before war begins. I made it. Wasn't sure I would. Anyway, I am Samuel Trapp, and I'm very glad you joined us tonight. I was covering mostly BRICS, a little bit of the topic of the Ukraine and some strange events. Here we are at International Flavor, where international news just tastes better. don't you think? Thank you for joining me. You can join me at damradio.com Sundays through Thursdays at 9 p.m. And you can listen to my podcasts at internationalflavor.com, where they will all be uploaded, including this one. As soon as the show is over, I shall upload it, and we shall go from there. Thank you so very much, and I will see you tomorrow.